Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really digging into three critical areas where global security agreements, the ones built up over decades, are facing, well, some serious stress tests.
That's absolutely right. We've got sources looking at the immediate problem with U.S.-Russia nuclear arms, the deeper challenges facing non-proliferation generally, and also a really tough situation. A country at war feeling forced to step back from a mine ban treaty.
And the common thread here, it seems, is how big geopolitical shifts like the war in Ukraine, China's military growth, are kind of chipping away at these stability mechanisms we've relied on.
Exactly. We need to unpack what's happening with three specific treaties. New START between the U.S. and Russia, the Global Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, and the Ottawa Convention on Landmines.
It feels like these aren't just separate issues, are they? They sort of point to a bigger trend.
I think so. It's maybe a move away from that rules-based approach towards something where national interest, even survival, really takes precedence over international agreements.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with that really pressing issue, New START. Its expiration date is looming, isn't it?
It is, February 2026. And, you know, the 2010 New START Treaty, it's been the main thing keeping U.S. and Russian strategic nuclear stockpiles down to levels we hadn't seen since, well, the 1960s.
And Russia has already put something on the table, haven't they? A proposal from Putin back in September.
Yeah, September 22nd, 2025.
Yeah.
Putin basically said, Russia's willing to keep sticking to the main numerical limits for one more year after the treaty expires, but only if the U.S. does the same.
Hmm. And as of early October 2025, no official U.S. response yet?
Not formally, no. Though we know the previous administration seemed keen on avoiding expiration altogether, so the idea has been floated before.
Okay, to really get what's at stake, we need those specific limits. What exactly does New START restrict?
Right, there are three key caps that fully kicked in back in 2018. First, neither side can have more than 700 deployed ICBMs, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs, and heavy bombers equipped for nuclear weapons.
Okay, 700 deployed delivery systems.
Second, no more than 800 total delivery systems, deployed and non-deployed. So that includes launchers in maintenance or storage.
Got it. And the third one, the one that causes the most anxiety.
That's the limit of 1550 deployed strategic warheads. And, you know, that's the core of the problem now, because counting those warheads depends heavily on verification.
Which is totally broken down. Walk us through how that happened.
Well, the system relies on data sharing, notifications, and crucially, on-site inspections, teams going into the other country's bases.
Right.
Those inspections got paused by both sides in 2020, you know, because of COVID. Then, in 2022, the U.S. wanted to restart them, but Russia just said no.
And then came Putin's announcement in early 2023.
Exactly. February 2023, Putin announced Russia was suspending his participation in the treaty. Mostly political signaling over Ukraine, it seemed.
But they did add a caveat, didn't they? About the numbers.
They did. Moscow made it clear they were suspending the process, the inspections, the data sharing. But they would still voluntarily stick to those three numerical limits until the treaty actually expired in 2026.
So the U.S. followed suit.
Pretty much. In June 2023, the U.S. announced it was also suspending its implementation of the verification stuff, like sharing data, but it too would stay within the numerical limits. It's this kind of fragile, unverified mutual restraint.
Which leads us straight to this 1550 problem. Why is that specific limit so hard to track now?
Because our satellites, our national technical means, they're really good at counting the big things, missile silos, submarines, bombers. So we have pretty high confidence about the 700 and 800 limits.
Okay.
But counting the actual warheads loaded onto those missiles and bombers, that's much, much harder without inspectors on the ground and the data exchanges the treaty required. That 1550 limit really relies on transparency.
And transparency is obviously gone. Are there real worries in D.C. that Russia might already be over the limit?
There are. A U.S. government report from January 2025, so fairly recently, assessed that Russia may have already exceeded that 1550 deployed warhead limit sometime in 2024. We just don't know for sure.
Okay, so Putin offers a one-year extension, sticking to the numbers, without restarting verification. What are the downsides for Washington in taking that deal?
Well, first, the obvious one.
Okay.
Without verification, confidence just keeps eroding. You don't know what the other side is really doing. Second, Russia's track record isn't great, is it?
You mean with treaty compliance?
Yeah. They violated New START's inspection rules in 2022. And let's not forget the INF treaty collapse in 2019, which was due to Russia deploying a banned missile. So there's a trust deficit, a big one.
And then there's the factor looming over everything, China.
Absolutely. China's nuclear buildup is dramatic. There may be around 600 warheads now, but growing fast. And this is forcing U.S. defense planners to think seriously about increasing their own deployed numbers.
How would they do that?
It's called uploading. Basically taking missiles and bombers that aren't currently carrying their maximum number of warheads and adding more. It's a direct response to China, which, by the way, keeps saying it won't join any three-way arms talks.
Just for context, the U.S. has around 3,700 total warheads, Russia maybe 4,300. China's 600 seems smaller, but it's the rate of expansion that's changing the game. And the U.K. and France together have about 500.
Exactly. So, given all that, what are the arguments for taking Putin's one-year offer? Even flawed as it is.
There must be some upsides.
There are. It maintains at least some predictability in the U.S.-Russia relationship. It might slow down what looks like an emerging three-way arms race.
Yeah.
And critically, it buys time. Time maybe to try and get talks going again on strategic stability, which haven't happened for 3 years now.
So the suggestion is maybe link accepting the extension to Russia, agreeing to restart those stability talks?
That seems to be the thinking. But the big takeaway is, if New START dies completely in 2026 with nothing to replace it, we lose the last constraints on the world's two biggest nuclear arsenals.
We risk going back to that Cold War dynamic of just building more and more.
A very costly lesson the world learned once already. And, you know, this instability at the top between the U.S. and Russia, it inevitably affects the broader nonproliferation regime.
Right, which brings us perfectly to the Nonproliferation Treaty, the NPT. If the giants are struggling to maintain limits, what does that mean for preventing new nuclear powers? Especially with the NPT review conference just, what, 7 months away?
Yeah, the timing is critical. And our sources show there's actually a debate happening inside the U.S. about the NPT's value itself. Some are starting to whisper about malign neglect.
Malign neglect. That sounds ominous. What's the argument?
Well, some officials are apparently questioning if the NPT is still serving U.S. interests. They argue developing nations use it to push for disarmament, which the U.S. isn't ready for.
Okay.
And that Russia and China use it to criticize U.S. alliances, like potentially basing U.S. weapons forward.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the big criticism, it hasn't stopped North Korea or arguably slowed down Iran enough.
So the idea is just let it wither. What's the supposed benefit of that?
It sounds cynical, but the argument is competition. If the NPT fades, U.S. nuclear companies might face fewer nonproliferation hurdles when competing against Russia and China for contracts in the global nuclear energy market. It's basically, if we can't enforce it properly, why let it tie our hands?
But this isn't the first time the U.S. has seemed, let's say, less than enthusiastic about enforcing non-proliferation rules, is it? The sources point to a history here.
Oh, absolutely. The track record has some worrying precedents. Look at North Korea in 2003. They announced they're leaving the NPT, and the U.S. reaction was quite muted. Sanctions only really came 3 years later after they tested a nuclear device.
Sanctions, a bad signal.
A very bad signal. Or India, not even an NPT member, they tested a bomb in 74, claimed it was peaceful, right? Then in 2005, the U.S. essentially rewarded them by lifting bans on nuclear trade.
And Israel.
The U.S. apparently ignored evidence of an Israeli nuclear test back in 1979, violating the Partial Test Ban Treaty.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a pattern of sometimes prioritizing strategic ties over strict adherence to the rules.
Okay, against that backdrop, let's talk Iran. That seems to be the flashpoint right now, specifically their ability to make nuclear fuel.
It is. Key U.S. officials, like the Energy Secretary and the Special Envoy, are taking a very hard line. Iran must give up enriching uranium, making fuel, because that capability is what enables potential weaponization. Full stop.
That's a strong stance, but it raises awkward questions, doesn't it, given past U.S. policy?
It does, because back in the 80s, the U.S. actually allowed Japan and several European countries under Uranium to develop their own fuel cycles. And even the 2015 Iran deal, the JCPOA, permitted limited enrichment.
So demanding zero enrichment from Iran now, while potentially allowing allies like, say, Saudi Arabia or South Korea to pursue it for civilian power,
yeah,
that looks like a double standard.
It's a difficult position the U.S. will have to navigate very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Consistency is key if you want the rules to stick.
Now, there's this counter-argument floating around. Maybe the U.S. should actually help friendly nations get closer to having nuclear weapons as a deterrent against, say, China. What do the analysts think of that?
The sources dismiss that pretty strongly, calls it magical thinking. The comparison is made to the lead-up to the world wars, frantic alliance building and arms buildups didn't prevent conflict, they might have fueled it.
More nuclear states just means more risk.
Exactly. More risk of miscalculation, accidents, proliferation cascades. Plus, it drives up U.S. defense costs, and you need more missile defenses, like this Golden Dome initiative mentioned. It doesn't actually simplify security.
So despite the flaws in the history, the recommendation is still to try and strengthen the NPT, not abandon it.
That's the conclusion, yes. Mm-hmm. Double down. Be firm with Iran on enrichment. But crucially, the U.S. needs to make it crystal clear that any future nuclear cooperation deals with non-nuclear weapon states will require those states to commit to not pursuing their own fuel-making capabilities.
Reestablish that clear red line.
Precisely. If you want the benefits of peaceful nuclear energy under the NPT umbrella, you forego the most dangerous technologies.
Okay, let's pivot one last time. We've talked strategic arms, we've talked proliferation. Now a very different kind of treaty. The Ottawa Convention banning anti-personnel landmines, this feels less about grand strategy and more about, well, immediate human cost.
It absolutely is. Mm. And what Ukraine has done here is quite extraordinary and, frankly, heartbreaking.
Mm.
On June 29th, 2025, the president signed a decree to effectively exit the Ottawa Convention.
Wow. Ukraine signed that treaty back in 1999. That's a huge reversal.
It is. They'd been destroying their stockpiles for years, down from over 6 million mines to around 3.3 million by 2020. They clearly believed in the treaty's goals, but the invasion changed everything.
What was the trigger on the ground? Why now?
It's the sheer scale of Russian mine use. Russia isn't party to the treaty, and they've used at least 13 different types of anti-personnel mines extensively. Estimates are that nearly a quarter of Ukraine's territory is contaminated.
23%. That's staggering.
It is. And militarily, Ukrainian offensives were getting bogged down, literally stopped cold by these dense minefields. Add the terrible toll on returning civilians and veterans. Adhering to the ban started to look like unilateral disarmament in the face of an existential threat.
Did Ukraine try other avenues first? Did they appeal to the treaty body?
They did, yes. Back in 2016 and 2018, they formally complained to the treaty's depositary about Russia's aggression, highlighting that a non-member was using mines against a member. But apparently, they received little support or acknowledgement.
So the Ukrainian Foreign Ministry basically said this was just common sense self-preservation.
Pretty much. They called it a difficult but necessary decision, a matter of elementary common sense to protect their land and people from atrocities.
But there's a crucial legal point here. They didn't technically withdraw, did they? They used a different mechanism.
That's right, and it's a really important distinction. The initial decree used the word withdrawal, but the formal step Ukraine took was suspension based on Article 62 of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties.
Okay, Article 62. That relates to a fundamental change of circumstances, right? The old legal idea of rebus sexy stantibus.
Exactly. They deliberately chose suspension, not the treaty's own withdrawal clause, Article 20. Why? Because suspension under the Vienna Convention's Article 72 implies it's temporary.
Ah, so they intend to come back into compliance once the situation changes.
That's the stated intention. Suspension allows them to be temporarily released from their obligations while keeping the treaty relationship intact. They're signaling they still believe in the convention, just that circumstances make adherence impossible right now.
And the fundamental change they're citing is pretty extreme.
Extremely. They point to three things. First, Russia's massive mine use creating an impossible military asymmetry. Second, the failure of the security assurances Ukraine was given in the past, like the Budapest Memorandum. And third, the most powerful claim, that Russia's actions amount to an attempt to completely exterminate Ukrainians as a nation, essentially citing genocide.
Using genocide and failed security guarantees as the justification? That's a much stronger legal argument than just saying we're in a war.
It is. Ukraine is framing this as an unprecedented situation.
Mm-hmm.
The Ottawa Convention's drafters just didn't anticipate a long, brutal war of aggression by a powerful non-member against a member. They argue they aren't abandoning the treaty's principles, just seeking temporary relief from an existential threat the international system failed to prevent.
So when you step back and look at all three New START teetering, the NPT under internal pressure, Ottawa being suspended mid-conflict, it paints a pretty sobering picture of international agreements under strain.
It really does. In each case, whether it's strategic competition, proliferation fears, or outright war, nations are calculating whether the security they get from the treaty is worth the constraint it imposes. And increasingly, the answer seems to be maybe not.
It feels like a real moment of vulnerability for that whole system of multilateral arms control and humanitarian law.
I agree. We're seeing foundational rules being challenged, bent, or set aside when perceived national security interests clash with international commitments.
So the final thought for you, the listener. If the U.S. and Russia might have to relearn the dangers of an unconstrained arms race, if the NPT's value is being questioned from within, and if a country can suspend a humanitarian treaty citing genocide and failed security pacts, what does that tell us about the real strength and future of these international rules in a world facing high-stakes conflict? What stands out to YU as the most worrying sign?